Norman Lebrecht is the English culture buff and blogger, author of Why Mahler? How One Man and Ten Symphonies Changed Our World. He's made a lively career stalking the life inside the man's music, conversations with Freud, the rivalry with Richard Strauss. He still speaks of Gustav Mahler in the present tense as a living force in the culture. I asked him in a conversation over Skype about Mahler's Ninth Symphony, which comes right at that modern moment around 1910, when Virginia Woolf famously said, "Everything changed, including human character." That was a century ago. I was thinking of the F. Scott Fitzgerald line that there are no second acts in American lives. I put it to Norman Lebrecht. Do Mahler and his music have a second century coming? His answer is yes, and it's not entirely good news.
It's a fairly simple answer. No composer in the history of music has ever been derided in his lifetime, neglected for half a century afterwards, and then returned to challenge Beethoven for centrality in the concert hall. That's what's happened to Mahler. He died in 1911, the revival began in the 1960s, and today Mahler stands in our perception of concert music as Beethoven did for much of the 19th and the 20th century. In a sense, music of today begins with Mahler. That's why Mahler.
Meaning what?
Meaning that he addresses many of the issues that we regard as contemporary, many of the issues that are the big questions of our lives. How does one spend one's time on earth? How does one manage relationships? How does one deal with conflict in relationships? What does one do when they go bad? All of that's in Mahler's life and in his music. It's writ large. And if anyone who's ever had to struggle for anything in life, whether it's a professional achievement, whether it's for the person that they most desired, anyone who has experienced a sense of struggle and then a sense of the fragility of achievement will find an echo in Mahler, a resonance, and possibly a way to give their own experience a larger context.
And the very great ones do return to the ultimate existential, sometimes individual, but critical problems of life and death and survival and pain and loss, as God knows he does.
The Ninth Symphony addresses the question that crosses everyone's mind and everyone's path, which is, how do we cope with the inevitability of extinction? We're not going to be here forever. Life is draining through our fingers like grains of sand. We know it even when we're young, as we grow older, as we move into middle age, as we start experiencing the stresses and strains of middle life, as health begins to fail. How do we find meaning, not just in what has been, but in the actual experience of losing control of one's own destiny? Nobody has addressed those questions in a more comprehensive and intensive, introspective way than Gustav Mahler did in 1909 when he sat down to write his Ninth Symphony. He had been told by doctors that his heart could give out at any moment. He was in his late 40s. He was world famous. He had turned the Vienna Opera into a world institution, run it for 10 years, then gone to New York, conducted at the Met, and was in the process of turning the New York Philharmonic into what it is today, an orchestra, not just of power, but of ideas. And in the course of that, he lived every day with the fear that a cardiac incident would finish him off, and finish him off quickly. He didn't have much longer to live. So the questions that he's addressing in the Ninth are, what are we here for? How long are we here for? And how do we make the equation between those two things? And he does it in quite a confrontational way with destiny, but not in the way that, say Moses confronted God. He doesn't argue. He doesn't shout out loud. But he lays out the issues in the symphony with a kind of emotional intelligence that reaches out to people who have no idea what the symphony is about. You will sit there and listen to that work, and at a certain point, you will feel gripped by something that you can't quite define, you can't quite decide. And that clearly is something that is going on in your own life rather than Mahler's.
But isn't it strange, Norman Lebrecht, that there he is, 1909, dies in 1911, at the modern moment when Virginia Woolf said everything changed, he is at the threshold between the Romantic period and the modernism of Schoenberg, but also Picasso, people we all know, Joyce, a new century, World War I days away, so to speak. He marks that moment. Does that moment still live? You write your book about Mahler in the continuous present, which is sort of fascinating as a man of our time. But that's a century ago now.
I chose to write it in the present continuous because that's how Mahler was writing, in the present continuous. He had a sense, as did those around him, the ones you mentioned, Picasso, Joyce, Einstein, they were reinventing the world. They were having to address a world that is reborn in the 20th century, but they were having to do it in a language that belonged to a previous world. So crossing that divide, that's a huge thing to do. So he takes the language, he puts it into the present continuous, and at the same time he's creating, he's inventing, he's pushing out. Where does he go beyond the Ninth Symphony? Many people look upon the Ninth Symphony as the last word. They ignore the fact that he left a Tenth Symphony. He left it all but complete. And in the Tenth, he pushes tonality towards the edge of the cliff. There is one nine-note chord in the Tenth that is atonal in all but name and is one of the most shocking noises that you will ever hear in music. Mahler had a sense that he was entering a century of apocalypse, that although everything around him bespoke bourgeois comforts, Stefan Zweig, in his book about that period, The World of Yesterday, wrote that in Vienna at that time, everybody was prosperous. Cures were being invented every week for diseases. You put your money in the bank and it grew. It was a world of limitless confidence. And Mahler came along and said, we're on the edge of the cliff. We're going over. If we don't actually remedy this old world of falsities, we're heading for extinction. That's what the Ninth Symphony is about. That's what the Tenth Symphony is about. They are, in a certain sense, admonitory and prophetic. They call upon the world to mend its ways, to address both the physical realities and the emotional ones.
Norman Lebrecht, speak to my probably naive sense that that tradition is in fact dying in his hands there at the end of his life. And he connects, of course, to Schoenberg and Berg and the moderns, but that tradition is on the way out. On my great map of the culture, Dvorak comes to America and says the future, certainly of American music, is in the Negro melodies. Mm. And he sort of signals the point that the great breakthroughs in 20th century music really come from someplace else. They come from Africa and Havana and the Caribbean and New Orleans and the New World, yep, with a new pulse.
Mahler says exactly the same. He comes to America, he listens to black music. He says, I don't understand this, but this is going somewhere that I haven't been, and I think this may be the future. He is acutely aware of plurality, diversity, multiculturalism in music in a way that the older generation hadn't been, in a way that would have been alien and inadmissible and hostile to the generation of Bruckner and Brahms. He splits with Richard Strauss over this. Richard Strauss thinks he can still function in this old world, and Mahler is always pushing forward, is always curious, is always trying to find ways of addressing the new. And if you look at these two great contemporaries, we're hearing an awful lot of Richard Strauss this year because it's the 150th year of his birth. You look at the trajectory that Strauss followed in his final years, from 1944 onwards until his death in 1949, Strauss returns to the language that he shared and disputed with Mahler when they were both young men in the 1880s and 1890s. That is a fascinating conversation on its own. You look at the two of them side by side and you ask yourself, which is the modern Strauss who died almost at the middle of the 20th century, or Mahler who died almost at the beginning? Clearly it's Mahler.
Match the other obvious pair, Mahler and the man whose work he conducted almost for a lifetime, Richard Wagner.
Mahler worshipped Wagner as a man who broke down boundaries, as a revolutionary, as a visionary, a man who created worlds in his own image. This was difficult for him in a number of ways because Mahler was Jewish and he was aware of Wagner's anti-Semitism. He knew that there was a very strong reason that he was never asked to conduct at Bayreuth. He was never officially invited to Bayreuth. He had to go there. He had to pay his own ticket. So he was aware of the hostility and of the archaism of Wagner, of Wagner's attachment to a mythical German past to which Mahler himself could never belong, but his admiration for the scope of the work, the gigantism of the work, was limitless, and he was one of the great Wagner conductors in history.
How do the two legacies play out a century later?
Really interesting question, Chris. Wagner is a fantasy world. Wagner is today a form of escapism. You go into his world, you leave this world behind. You enter a place of forbidden relationships, of incest, of inadmissible greed, the kind of greed that would cause Wall Street to blanch. The murderous impulses, which provides us as listeners with a kind of vicarious existence. It's almost a second life experience going into Wagner, but it bears no relation to our 21st century realities. Mahler, you go and listen to that music, and you are thrust right into the cauldron of your own emotions, your own confusions, your own relationships, your own aspirations, desires, frustrations, failures. All of that's in Mahler, and it's all very real. It feels very, very contemporary.
Norman LeBrecq, on this side of the pond, the old saw is that there are no second acts in American life. Is there a second century ahead for Gustav Mahler?
Well, there's a third century ahead for Mozart, so I don't see why there shouldn't be a second century ahead for Gustav Mahler. I think there is. I think, you know, the issues that he addresses are so pressing. I've written a great deal and analyzed a great deal the conversation that took place, the 4.5-hour conversation that took place between Mahler and Sigmund Freud, after which Freud said no one had ever understood him so intuitively as Gustav Mahler. And Freud leaves us with the impression that he was being analyzed every bit as much as he was trying to analyze Gustav Mahler. So if we look to Freud for solutions to our worldly discomforts, we may find similar solutions in the music of Gustav Mahler, and that stuff doesn't go away, that stuff doesn't die. That's with us certainly for the rest of my life in York, Chris, and I think for our children and grandchildren. It was clear from the conversation between Freud and Mahler that Mahler felt greatly relieved as a result of it. When you follow Freud and how that conversation impacted on him and his practice, you can actually see that Freud was terrified of the particular unknown that Mahler represented. Freud was a rational being. Music is innately non-rational. It exists within its own language, within its own structure. And Freud did not take a single step further into trying to analyze music because he knew he would be lost.
But do we have any further clue as to what Freud meant when he said, in effect, Mahler gets it, about his unconscious, his dreams, his sex life, his childhood, his mother? Where does that go?
We get quite a lot from Freud's conversations with Marie Bonaparte, who was one of his closest associates and to whom he talked about his relationship with Mahler. That's there in the Bonaparte archives in France. But you also get an idea of what was unsaid between them, what was assumed between them. And the great connecting force between them was not so much the fact that they were both Jews who came from the same part of the country. They were pretty much contemporary. There were 6 years between them. They were both Viennese in the sense that they'd always looked to Vienna as the height of their aspiration. But the connecting ideal between them is that there is no text without context. Both of them look upon text or upon statement as the beginning of understanding, not as understanding itself. And if I were to give an analogy for that, it would be that of biblical studies, where you can't actually understand the Bible without reading through centuries upon centuries of exegesis of people who have sought to understand the Bible through the prism of their faith, be it Jewish, be it Christian, be it other. That is how Mahler and Freud saw the world, as a kind of central text surrounded by columns upon columns upon columns of commentaries and exegesis. Text and context is everything to both of them.
Norman Lebrecht, it's a great pleasure always to read you and especially to hear you on Open Source.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Chris, on WBR and Open Source.